you're not interested in the sermon today, you might just want to contemplate the snap and poop and see if you can find the connections between the snap and poop and Zephaniah. I think there are connections between the snap and poop and Zephaniah, but perhaps I'm making it up. Or you may also wish to just sit with, what does it mean for you that you're on Whadjuk Noongar land that was never ceded? We say that week after week. What does that mean? That can be a place to sit today, or you can listen to what I have to say. So a week ago I knew nothing at all about Zephaniah, and it's the lectionary reading for today, so I thought, jolly good, I'll give it a go. And I read Zephaniah. So did anyone else read Zephaniah this week? Oh, excellent. So the bit that's the lectionary reading is what Lee read, which is I'm actually very familiar with because I grew up in a church that read that in Advent year after year. Daughter of Zion, rejoice, rejoice. It's beautiful, beautiful poetry. Zephaniah is the ninth of the book of 12 prophets, which are sometimes called the minor prophets, not because they're less important, but just because they're short. And as in not short, they're short. And they have very similar themes to each other, and Zephaniah repeats those themes. The major themes are the people of God have been unfaithful to God, the people of Yahweh. They've failed the poor and the vulnerable. They've got caught up in power structures, and so have forgotten Yahweh, their God. And they're worshipping other gods. And the implication, sometimes more explicit than others in the prophets, is that if they were to focus on Yahweh, they wouldn't oppress the poor. And the fact that they're worshipping other gods is part of the cause of their oppressing the poor, because they've taken off the God who reminds them of the, they're taking their eyes off the God who reminds them of the poor. And in response to this, Yahweh is sad and Yahweh is angry. And Yahweh intends to either cause or at least allow this nation that is the people of God to be destroyed. And particularly that anyone who has power or wealth or privilege, it will be taken away. And the other major theme through all the prophets is that despite or through this devastation somehow, Yahweh's faithful love will be with them, will carve a way forward, a new life for the community, a return to some loving relationship with Yahweh God. Zephaniah at three chapters is a very relatively concise version of saying that, but that's kind of the gist of the prophetic literature. And the context for all of those prophets, the minor and the major, is the historical period when Assyria destroyed the northern kingdom Israel, and then 100 or so years later Babylon destroyed the southern kingdom Judah and took away the elites into exile in Babylon, and the land was then left in a quite lawless state under foreign kind of quasi-rule with some of the poor remaining. And it was a terrible time of trauma. And it's not clear where exactly in that timeline Zephaniah was written. The first line of Zephaniah says written in the time of Josiah, but it's the very sort of thing that people just put on the top of a book that they like. So whether it's written in the time of Josiah or not is impossible to say. There's no other clues in the book that would suggest Josiah in particular. But wherever Zephaniah fits in that timeline, the text reflects the terror and confusion for a community suffering invasion and war and destruction, and particularly for people who believed they were protected by their God and experienced what for them felt like not being protected by their God when everything they knew was torn apart. And like the other prophet, Zephaniah offers both an explanation for the disaster and a comfort. The explanation is Yahweh God has not failed. Yahweh God is issuing a just punishment. And the comfort is Yahweh still loves you, Yahweh is with you, and Yahweh will bring you through this to a time of peace and joy. Walter Brueggemann says the two temptations of the exile were assimilation and despair, and that the prophets speak into that. To assimilation, they say, don't assimilate, that's what caused the problem in the first place. And to despair, they say, God is with you, God is bringing you into a new something, it'll be okay. So there's no specific time or context that Zephaniah is linked to within the text, which has made Zephaniah a book that, from very early on, was seen to have a kind of universal application because it's not advising a particular king or a particular time. So that's part of why it's included in the book of the 12 and passed on. And now the most obvious way to read this is to say God couldn't stand the behaviour of God's people anymore, so God allowed them to be destroyed, to teach them a lesson and to hopefully bring them back into relationship. And yet a small number of what Zephaniah are called the humble ones, which implies the poor, the needy, a small remnant retain favour. And out of that small, humble remnant, Yahweh will rebuild a new society, a new community that will be in right relationship with God. And then our easiest way to read that for us is to see ourselves as descendants of that remnant, inheritors of the tradition of being the humble ones who survived, on whom God's favour rests. And the what do we do with it then? That our job out of that reading is to make sure we don't get as sinful as the lot that got destroyed, to keep ourselves in God's favour. I have some problems with that reading of the text. Maybe just pay attention to yourself. What is sitting with you? How is this text sitting with you so far? If you read the whole thing this week, the whole three chapters, or if you just listened to Lee read that hymn at the end, allow space for your response so you're not just listening to me. Two parts of what I find problematic about the obvious and easy reading of Zephaniah. One is our tendency to put ourselves with the surviving humble remnant, because good news for the oppressed is bad news for the powerful, usually. And we are indisputably among the powerful. If Yahweh is breaking and remaking the world in an ongoing way, as this text, this reading of the text implies, then we can expect to be among the broken. If Yahweh is building a new community from the perspective of the humble and the poor, that won't be our perspective. Our place in this text on the straight reading is with the condemned. So to get a feel for how that might feel to read the text that way, the phrase used is daughter of Zion, but I'd like to imagine it said daughters of Zion and was addressing the women of Jerusalem. Daughter of Zion is a word that sort of means Jerusalem. The women of Jerusalem at the time are very much those outside the power structures who might be considered the oppressed or the humble. What if this text was saying, I will destroy the structures of patriarchy that are holding you, and I will rebuild a community from the remnant of the daughters of Zion after I've destroyed, and that destruction will be painful of the structures that oppress at the moment. I will rebuild a community based around the daughters of Zion. Now, particularly men, how does that feel? To say, because the text doesn't just say I'll change the structures, the text suggests that those who benefit from the old structures will be destroyed. Does that still feel like an okay reading of this text? And now I've made it easy for me because I've just put myself with the group that survives, which is jolly convenient. So let me do the reading, let me do the imaginative reading again. With this text as a decree against colonisers and all those who benefit from the inheritance of colonisation, whether that's descendants of colonisers or whether that's migrants who've assimilated into the colonising nation. What if we colonisers are overturned and a new world is built entirely from the perspective of traditional owners? Not just a new world that we are part of, but that the colonisers are destroyed and the traditional owners are the kernel of the new thing. Now, potentially, this text then could help us to reorient away from our inherited colonist power, to become vulnerable and to be guided by perspectives of the Whadjuk Noongar people, whose land we acknowledge week by week. And we might agree that that's a good idea, but it does leave us with a text that calls for our complete destruction and condemnation. It is not a text that's calling for a reconciled society having another think. So that is one of my problems with the straight reading of this text, is that that's where we end up. My second problem with this straight reading is that I think it feeds what I like to call the Noah fantasy. The Noah fantasy goes something like this. God will punish the bad majority and save a good minority and start again. That's the flood story. And I think the reason that we have the Noah story in our collection of sacred texts and we have it so early and stated so strongly is to have it laid down at the start of our journey into this sacred text that that is not the way God works. That God tried that way and it failed. And so we have the rainbow promise that God will never again destroy the bad majority and save a small minority to build the new world. Because that attempt to address the broken relationship meant that the people God loved died and suffered, and God was not okay with that. And it didn't work anyway. The few who were saved did not build a community that was in lovely relationship with God. They just went right on building a community that was on the old structures. If we read Zephaniah as a Noah fantasy, then we are saying God did try again to use that approach, and we are saying the rainbow promise is a lie. And I think implicitly lots of Christian teachings do this. We imply that actually the rainbow promise of the Noah story is a lie and that God will actually, again sometime, wipe out all the bad people, inverted commas, and keep a few good ones, which always includes us, to rebuild again. What a terrible arrogance. And what a truly horrible God to worship. Because it says, as long as we, the saved small group in the ark, the saved remnant in Zephaniah, as long as we're okay, it doesn't matter what happened to all the rest. I think we all carry the Noah fantasy, and it has a deep attraction. I think the Schnappenpoop book shows the Noah fantasy. Because partly when the brother gets done in, we all rejoice. And then we find ourselves going, oh, maybe we should be worried about what happened to the brother. But it raises for us that sense of he's really awful. He's a really mean boy. And then he gets, you know, he gets his just desserts. And that's the Noah fantasy. That somehow they'll just get wiped away and we'll be left with only the winged lion and the unicorn and lovely playing in the hills. For those who are listening to this on the recording who didn't have the Schnappenpoop a children's book, you just need to talk to someone who is here. I'll borrow the book whose author I, on the top of my head, can't remember. So I'm going to suggest another way to read Zephaniah, and this is the way I can hold this text with integrity for myself. And I have to say up front, this is not the way that commentators read this text. And I could be wrong, because this is how I've managed to come at holding this, but it's not what I'm reading in other people. The repeat motif in Zephaniah is the day of Yahweh, the day of the Lord. And I believe that the whole book is a dramatic presentation of Yahweh's decision-making about what sort of day that will be. And so the option for violent destruction is considered quite colourfully and at length, but the cost is too high. I think Zephaniah quite deliberately alludes to the Noah fantasy by using imagery at the start about wiping out everything. So let me read you Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 2 and 3. I shall sweep away everything off the face of the earth, declares Yahweh. I shall sweep away humans and animals, birds of the air and fish of the sea. I shall topple the wicked and wipe all people from the face of the earth. That is the language of uncreation and the language of the flood. That is the language that the rainbow promise said never again to. And then within Zephaniah, that Noah fantasy is undone. At chapter 3, verse 7, after extensively discussing how that fantasy is going to be played out, Yahweh says, I thought at least you will fear me, at least you will bow to correction, and none of the punishments I brought on them will disappear from their view. But no, it only made them more anxious to do what was corrupt. In other words, punishing the evil ways of people doesn't motivate them to live the way Yahweh wants them to and doesn't restore relationship. And so Yahweh God changes Yahweh's mind. First, for a few verses, Yahweh toys with the idea of saving a remnant rather than wiping off every living thing. But that is still the Noah fantasy, isn't it? And so at chapter 3, verse 14, which is where our reading today starts in the lectionary, a totally new idea breaks in. Shout for joy, daughter of Zion, because Yahweh has dropped the charge against you. Please notice, no one repented. Yahweh just made a decision. Just made a decision. And how does God, Yahweh God, feel about this? Verse 17 and 18 say, Yahweh will dance and shout for joy at this outcome. And the term for love here, I don't read Hebrew, but I'm told that there's a couple different words for love in Hebrew. This is a Hebrew text. And that there's a word for love that means dutiful, faithful acts of loving kindness, the willing act of loving someone. And that's not the word that's used here. The word that's used here is the term for passionate affection, the movement of the heart to just care so much about someone you just want to do it. Yahweh doesn't decide for mercy because it's the right thing to do. Mercy is chosen because Yahweh cares so deeply about the people who would otherwise be destroyed. Yahweh God chooses mercy because Yahweh God wants those people. We who are guilty of benefiting from the dispossession of Aboriginal people, we who are guilty of profiting from systems that oppress the poor, the very things that Zephaniah says enrages God to the point where God contemplates wiping off every living thing, God chooses to drop those charges against us, against you, against me. Just let's take a moment to just let that sink, because that is a huge, huge thing. Although you are complicit in the structures of oppression that offend God, God chooses to drop the charges against you. The language then of restoration in joy, restoration and joy, still puts the oppressed, the lame, the strays, it still puts these people in the centre. Yahweh's not changed priorities by saying, I'm not going to hold it against you. Yahweh hasn't decided that oppressive power structures are therefore okay. There are special words of comfort here in this last piece of Zephaniah for those who are currently afflicted. But those who are condemned for their evil ways have had their sentence repealed. Yahweh God will find another way. That's where Zephaniah leaves us at the end. And I believe that this other way that Yahweh God finds is the incarnation, is the way of Jesus. It's the slow change built on one person at a time, one plus one plus one, learning to love their neighbours, learning to accept themselves as loved. So that's why we read Zephaniah in Advent, because Zephaniah reminds us of the deeply unjust way that the world works. Zephaniah reminds us of the inadequacy of the Noah fantasy as a way to respond to that injustice. And Zephaniah gives us the hope of another way, a way based in mercy and incarnation, the way that God chose instead. So a new hope replaces the Noah fantasy, the hope that if Yahweh God forgives people, the people will live into the vision of a just, compassionate world based in the humble and the poor and not the powerful. Our job, our what do we do then from this text, is not avoid sin, as it is in the straight reading. Our job is respond to the mercy of God by living the way God wants us to. There are two sources of false hope that are dismantled in Zephaniah. One is the systems of religious and financial and political power that the elites of Zephaniah's time relied on for their security, and likewise the structures, the parallel structures that we rely on for our security, particularly our inherited privilege, I think. The other false hope is the Noah fantasy that violent destruction and starting again with a good few will solve the world's problems. And in their place, the true hope is offered, and that is the hope based in God's unilateral declaration of mercy and restoration. The hope in Zephaniah is not the hope of the people that God will save them. It is God hoping. It is God hoping for us. The joyful Daughter of Zion hymn that ends the book is not God's promise of an outcome, but God's expression of hope. What God promises is mercy. But what God hopes for is justice in response to mercy. And above all, the hymn of the Daughters of Zion emphasises, do not fear. There's Hebrew linguistic things about how you emphasise which bit, and the bit that's emphasised is do not fear. Whatever comes, and if Yahweh has decided not to wipe out your oppressors, you can be sure that whatever comes will mean lots of hardship for lots of people. Whatever comes, the text says, chapter 3, verse 17, Yahweh, your God, is there with you. God is in your midst. Chapter 3, verse 20, Yahweh says, I shall be your guide. This is not about some long, distant time at the end of everything when good will triumph over evil. This is about now, and it's about every now through history. Now, do not fear. God is with you. Your God. Your God who dances and shouts for joy at the thought of restoring you. This God, your God, is with you whatever comes.
Thank you. Verse 17, just towards the very end, he will quiet you by his love. The Hebrew word for love is a pretty common one, is ahava. But I just noticed that the word quiet, I've just forgotten how to say it, but I'll go straight to the meaning. It's like, okay, I'll do an approximation. Haras is the word for quiet. And it sounds to me like a mother holding a child who's crying, going shh, rather than being made to be quiet.
Thank you. If you were to get 10 different Bibles and read 3, verse 17 and 18, you would find 10 probably quite different versions of translation because, again, I guess I don't read Hebrew, but apparently all the words there are quite straightforward, but they just don't make any sense with each other. It's a string of words that don't really make a sentence, And so people have worked in lots of different ways with the context to try and say, what on earth did the person writing this mean? It's clearly words of comfort. There's something in there about festivals. If you want an interesting afternoon activity, go and check 10 different Bibles and see how very different those two verses are. But the notion of the God will soothe and comfort is certainly there in the piece, yeah.
One thing I noticed on was reading Snap and Poop is I went to the last page and I put an artificial the end in. I was reflecting on that and the fact that we actually find it quite unsatisfying as a story, because I think as adults we recognise we are both the meanie brother and the little brother. We hold both. We want a different ending.
I think probably a bunch of reasons why I like to go to the Hebrew, and that's because of what you were saying. There's so many different cuts on it. And David Cohen a little while ago suggested a particular app, if you like, that was put together by Cambridge, and it gives you all of the possible translations of a particular word. And most of the words there for harass, I think it's almost a play on haratz, which is means the earth. But I don't want to say that. It's like be silent, be dumb, be speechless, to be deaf, to make silent and to remain silent. It's like if we recognise the grace in the washing away of the judgments, apart from rejoicing, if you're upset, it's nice to be calmed.
I thought you might have chosen this as one of your difficult texts.
Oh, no, I'm done with them.
Are there any other or not? Because even with all that hope at the end, I don't know if it's because of climate change or something, but wanting to believe that this new way, this quiet way, one-to-one of people following the way of Jesus is going to impact on the power structures of the world, it's very hard to believe and to feel. And I guess for me, when I see churches that I see, oh, they hold up this model that I don't like, and it's easy to dismiss that. But I think, well, what about my model of the way of Jesus and being the way to challenge the power structures of the world? And, yeah, I have days when I can't believe it, and I want to. But, yeah, I'm wanting a bit more hope.
Sitting with me is the Noah promise story and the way of Jesus. Just before you got to Noah, what I registered was the problem I have with all the Old Testament prophets, which is the same thing. And really, in growing up in the evangelical tradition and even the evangelical social justice tradition that draws so heavily on Old Testament, Jubilee teaching, all that stuff, it is essentially saying God did this to people. So, yeah, so that's what's sitting with me is, so the way of Jesus is so radically different to that whole Old Testament prophetic tradition, essentially. Mm. Speaks to what you're saying too, Jan, about wanting that hope. And then where I went to, it's kind of like Gandhi, the non-violence movement, is the closest we have in our day and age to saying it will be different and it can be different, and that significant social change can still happen that way, but it's not the triumphant way in any way. Mm-hmm. So that's what's sitting with me unresolved. Mm-hmm. But thank you.
I'm going to repeat my last piece again to finish. Do not fear, for God is with you, your God who dances and shouts for joy at the thought of restoring you, is with you whatever comes.